You are listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with Viet Thanh Nguyen, Vietnamese-American novelist, scholar, and Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Sympathizer. His podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
We're already at war with immigrants. That's the explicitly stated goal of the Trump administration. And there's an internal war against these immigrants, an acceleration of the militarization domestically of the United States, which is an indicator of how much more military aggression in terms of foreign policy the United States will exercise. But let's be clear that this is an outcome of Democratic policy, too. The Democrats have been wholehearted supporters of the forever war. Democrats have been responsible for a lot of the wars that the United States has fought in the post-World War II era. Democrats have also given legitimacy to extrajudicial drone strikes and to the militarization of the police domestically. So even if the Republican Party under Donald Trump is accelerating things, the Democrats have also been very complicit in a lot of this as well. So yes, we are an empire that is past its peak, that is struggling to hang on via force and violence versus diplomacy and negotiation. These are very, very bad signs, but they're also repetitions of things that the United States has been doing fairly consistently in the post-World War II era. If we look at a country like France, which is in the second position at this point, we can see how difficult it was for France to lose its empire. And that's, again, what Baldwin is documenting. No Name in the Street begins in 1948 in Paris as Baldwin shows up. And he witnesses the decline of the French empire as it loses its war in Indochina and as it's waging its war in Algeria. And he talks about how incredibly violent France is at this time. Domestically, he's witnessing the abuse of Algerians, of Arabs, of anybody who does not look white in France as the French Empire turns its energies not just against Algerians in Algeria, but against anybody who's suspect within France itself. What he depicts, what he describes, like the militarized police on the streets carrying machine guns, kidnapping people off the streets, beating them in the presence of white French people without any repercussions, spearing them away to camps, and people not being able to do anything about it, it's almost exactly like what the United States is doing today. You know, France went through a very long period of unrest, of violence, as it lost its grip. And even today, obviously, if we look at France, we can see how the nostalgia for French empire is still dominant in terms of how domestic French politics are being played out. So even a second-rank imperial state like France still struggles with what it means to lose global power. And so I think it's going to be an extremely ugly period as a first-rank empire, the United States, is forced to come to grips with its decline. The United States is not willingly coming to grips with that. It's being forced to through the global competition posed by other countries. Whatever we think of those other countries, it's a different issue. But the United States is itself not giving up its privileges gracefully at this point, and the consequences will be extreme, not just for the United States itself, but for every other country that it interacts with. And those processes of being an other for me in the United States were obviously very fundamental to shaping who I am as a person and as a writer. And it was a very difficult experience to undergo, but to become a writer who could talk about those issues was also a lot of fun. And writing The Sympathizer was a lot of fun, and I hope that the novel was enjoyable and humorous to read despite its very serious politics. And when I wrote The Committed, I had a lot of fun. As an outsider to France, I was an other in some ways, but certainly not in the most dramatic sense, which is what I was depicting in the novel. That is, the other who was an Algerian, who was an Arab, who was North African, who was Black. I think those experiences of otherness within France are not something that a tourist experiences, but something a tourist can only witness from afar. So some of the things that Baldwin saw, I actually saw glimpses of as well. I mean, Baldwin describes watching an Algerian being beat in front of a French cafe. And I have to say, I saw the exact same experience with a Black man being beat in front of a cafe in central Paris, and people just watching and not doing anything about it. And the police were just completely free to do whatever they wanted. It was shocking for me to see that. At least in the United States at that time, this was the early 2000s, the police had the sense to just beat people in places where white people couldn't see that happening. But in France, it was like, well, we'll just beat you in the streets of central Paris where the tourists can see it and where white French people can see it. It was shocking. So there was no humor in that. But in writing the novel itself, The Committed, there was a lot of humor. And humor, satire, these kinds of tools to confront the tragedy of othering is very important to me as literary and political devices. I think I could do that in both The Sympathizer and The Committed because I had a lot of distance from the time periods that those novels describe. My challenge right now is to try to find my sense of humor in describing what the United States is undergoing and doing to other countries and to its own immigrants and its own people of color and its own minorities in the present. You mentioned the other book that I wrote, or the lectures, To Save and to Destroy, Writing as an Other. And those processes of being an other for me in the United States were obviously very fundamental to shaping who I am as a person and as a writer. And it was a very difficult experience to undergo, but it, you know, to become a writer who could talk about those issues was also a lot of fun. And writing The Sympathizer was a lot of fun. And I hope that the novel was enjoyable and humorous to read, despite its very serious politics. And when I wrote The Committed, I also had a lot of fun. As an outsider to France is mechanized in order to divide people through the use of actual geographical borders to separate one nation from another, but also with domestically within a nation to divide populations from each other, to say that population A is different than population B. These are different kinds of minorities, for example. You have nothing in common. You should identify with the state and what it's doing and so forth. So the whole power of the state is geared towards dividing and conquering, whether it's domestically within a state, whether it's exercising its power overseas and things like colonization, which is all about dividing and conquering. So in the face of that, to engage in expansive solidarity and capacious grief is to work against the mechanisms of colonialism and militarism and the state. It's enormously difficult, which is why it has to be rebuilt from every generation, because every generation is subject to the power of the state and its ideologies and its mythologies and so on. So I think the lessons that I've extracted from that in this book, To Save and to Destroy, where I talk about expansive solidarity and capacious grief, these are lessons that, again, have been learned by other people before me, but lessons that I had to learn for myself and to put into my own words how I came to those lessons. So as a writer, I do believe that art and literature in and of themselves are important. One of the most important reasons why is because, as you mentioned, language is crucial. Part of the way that states and authoritarian regimes exercise their power is not just through physical violence and intimidation, but through a maltreatment of language itself. I mean, Trump is a perfect example of this. Everything that comes out of his mouth in terms of language is horrifying for anybody who has any sensitivity to language. You know, the excesses of his language in terms of insults, in terms of hyperbolic praise for his sycophants and so on. It's a perfect example of how language is used by an authoritarian and by the state in order to obfuscate reality and in order to intimidate people. That language is ugly from my perspective. And so there is something about being committed to literature and to art that awakens us to the importance of beauty. However you choose to define beauty, that's a very subjective definition. But I think every artist is committed to beauty. And I think about what John Keats, the poet, said, beauty is truth, truth, beauty. You can't separate these kinds of things. So if you're committed to the beauty of language, you're also committed to this idea that language has a relationship to truth. And you can see that authoritarians don't have a relationship to truth. They have a relationship to the abuse of truth and to lying, not only in content, but in the form of their language as well. So there's a really crucial role for writers here and our relationship to language, because language is one of the most crucial ways that authoritarianism extends its power. What I've discovered as a writer is that fear is a good indicator that there is a truth. To speak the truth in a society is oftentimes an act that requires courage, because no society wants to have its hypocrisies, its absurdities, its contradictions pointed out, which means there's always a role for a writer or an intellectual or an artist to speak the truth. And then there's always the possibility of that writer or intellectual or artist being penalized in some ways for what they say. So if you encounter fear in your project, it's a good sign that you're somewhere on the verge of a truth that is hard to articulate. That truth could be about your society, but could also be about yourself and your family. And so that has been true for me, writing things that are more explicitly political. So for example, oftentimes I'll give talks to audiences in places that I think maybe they won't like what I have to say. I get very nervous. For example, giving a talk at West Point, the United States' premier military academy for training its military officers, I've said many of the same things that I've said to you. And before giving that talk, I was quite nervous, quite fearful. But I felt it was necessary to go ahead and say these things, because who else needs to hear this than the military officers of the United States? And likewise, with writing a memoir about my family and myself, this was the most difficult thing I'd ever done. In finishing that book, I felt actually a visceral level of agony that I'd never experienced before as a writer. And by visceral, I mean I felt it in my gut. The first time that I had other people read this manuscript besides my partner, I just felt physically ill, because I thought, I'm betraying my mother and my family by talking about things that they would rather not have anyone know about. And yet I felt that these things were truthful and that they needed to be said, not just out of some kind of impulse of vanity, but because I think that what happened to my mother and to my family were not just private individual things, but also outcomes of colonialism and racism and war. And for me as a writer, the only place to go is to the place of truth and of fear. This was 2023 when I was going to give this lecture, and we had just underwent COVID, and there was a whole surge of anti-Asian violence. And the fact that I was due to give a lecture on the death of Asian Americans forced me to think about how I could sort of merge these issues of Palestine, Israel, and Asian Americans. And so that lecture talks specifically about the mechanism of othering, that it's universal. So that what was done to the Jews in Germany and through anti-Semitism is also the same kind of process that's being done to Palestinians in Palestine and to other minorities in other kinds of locations. And so the trajectory from othering to genocide is very clear. It doesn't mean it's inevitable that it's going to happen, but the logic is already there from the very beginning. And the tragedy of what happens in Palestine and in Gaza, of course, is that one population of people who have been subjected to genocide, or at least their ancestors, are now perfectly comfortable with the possibility of inflicting genocide in another population. And the principle that has been advanced by Jewish people and their advocates to always remember and to never forget is absolutely right. But, of course, what we see is that in application, the principle has been reduced to a mechanism of nationalism. Always remember, never forget what was done to us, but always forget what we do to others. That is the mechanism of nationalism. And so the challenge here is the confusion between the two, right? The necessity of acknowledging that the Holocaust was wrong and we should always be against anti-Semitism, absolutely true. But if we believe in that, we can't give the state of Israel and its supporters any excuse for inflicting the very same thing that was done to Jewish people. And part of the challenge, of course, is that there is an alignment between the state of Israel and the state of the United States and the states of the West. That is now the alignment. So Jewish people as minorities, wherever they find themselves, who are subjected to anti-Semitism, that situation is not the same as the state of Israel and what it does to Palestinians. And that's what that lecture was about. And the idea that if we feel, as we should, capacious grief and expansive solidarity with the victims of anti-Semitism, with Jewish people whenever they experience that, so we should feel that for Palestinians when they're subjected to genocidal hatred and violence as well. And it's very difficult to make that argument when the entirety of the Western world is aligned with Israel and is designed to prevent that recognition from taking place. So it is a very difficult recognition. I don't think it's restricted only to Asian Americans, although I think Asian Americans should have that recognition. The whole idea was that artificial intelligence would displace the working class and the laboring classes and so on. But apparently AI poses just as much of a threat, maybe even more of a threat to the intellectual laborers of the world. But to think that AI could replace us because we are in some senses workers, that opens up a whole new dimension of expansive solidarity and capacious grief if writers and artists can think of themselves as workers as well, because AI is completely wrapped up with global capitalism, the extraction of profit from labor, and the transformation of everybody into the lowest paid commodity consumer possible, including writers, including the world of the arts. And so I think this is another acceleration of global capitalism that will bring us to new levels of contradiction. The outcome is not clear, because when people are confronted by the losses of their livelihoods, it doesn't make them necessarily into better human beings who are going to unite in solidarity and grief with other people in order to revolt against capitalism. It could turn them into really scared, anxious people vulnerable to demagoguery. And so I think that this is another choice that's being offered to us and will be offered to even more of us in the next decade or two. What I really wanted to do was to be a writer. And so to be a professor has been my day job for nearly 30 years at this point. And it's been great in some ways. It's taught me a lot. And it's allowed me to become a certain kind of a writer that I wouldn't have been, I think, if I did not have my PhD and if I had not been grappling with many of these theoretical and scholarly and philosophical ideals. For that, I'm grateful. But I think I stopped learning anything from being a professor about human nature 10 or 15 years ago. So it's been a matter of paying the bills for the last 10 or 15 years, which has been very dispiriting in some ways. So I'll be forever grateful to being a professor. But the larger mission has always been, as our conversation has been about, What can art do? What can literature do? What can language do? How can using these things make me a better writer, a better thinker about the human condition, but also my own condition? And being a professor no longer serves these ambitions.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.